This is the Half Hour Podcast, released January 8th, 2024. Episode 655, the 12th day of Kaiserness. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I am Jeff Kaiser, the mighty Ohm. and I just want to say, Chris, you're a little bit late. Yeah. You're a little bit late this year.
Man, story of my life these days, Jeff. Yes. Don't worry, kids. Kaisermas may be over, but...
Kaisermas was canceled.
Papa Kaiser delivered. This is the... what is it like the... You know, like the Russian Orthodox Church, they celebrate Christmas in January.
Oh, so
it's like that. Yeah, it's like this is going to be like Orthodox Kaisermas. Maybe we could put you in like a Russian hat or something like that.
I was thinking,
you know, the onion top church is behind you.
This is like Kaisermas, the Hangover edition. it's all behind us now. We did Christmas, we did New Year's, and here we are, January 2024, and I am back.
And a good Kaisermas to you, sir.
Ho, 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 yes.
On the 12th day of Kaisermas, the Jeffrey brought to me.
It's pretty soon it's going to be on the 12th day of January.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think we are actually getting to the 12th day of Christmas soon. So there you go. Yeah. Maybe we'll do 12 days of Kaisermas. I'm like going through my head. I'm like, what is the least amount of work it'll be to make art to do this? And then make a fun thing. What is the 12th day? The 12th day of the 12 days of Christmas is 12 Lords leaping? 12 drummers drumming?
I think it's 12 Lords leaping, isn't it?
12th day of Christmas. I've had this conversation many times. Oh, tomorrow is the 5th of the 12th day of Christmas.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah. Huh. Come on. 12 drummers drumming. All right.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Sorry.
It's a drum line here. Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Hey, welcome back, Jeff. What has been going on in the past year?
What has been going on this past year? I feel like I'm reaching a stage in my life where, like, if you talk about last year, I'm still thinking 2022. So, yeah, last year was kind of a crazy year for me. So I don't know if you remember, but the last time I was on the show, which is now not last year, but technically...
Okay,
in 2022.
We're just gonna pretend it's 2023 now. Yeah,
I'm gonna make sure you don't forget. But anyway, so last time I was on the show, I had just had like a really crazy year, and I was still doing the kit thing, which I still am. I'm still doing the kit thing. But I had just had like the craziest year in over 10 years of doing electronics kits, and things were kind of going wild, and I was really kind of struggling to kind of keep up with it because it had come out of nowhere, and I was just. You know, I'm a one-man operation, and so it was hard for me to kind of keep up. I'd started selling on Amazon, and it had been, like, really successful. So, anyway, 2023, that, like, totally reversed itself, and 2023 was actually comparatively, like, very, very slow. And it's the kind of thing that, as, like, a small business owner, you're like, okay, you know, I expected this. I was kind of dreading that this would happen, but, like, here it is. And to be honest, like, things are okay. You know, the Amazon store is still going okay. I still sell kits on my website. I still sell on Adafruit, but things are clearly kind of slowing down. And I'm definitely at that point where, you know, I've had this business going and I've had this kit, this Geiger counter kit that I know was selling for a long time. And I'm starting to kind of think about, okay, like the number of components that are becoming obsolete is increasing, like silly things too, like through-hole resistors and like things that you just like, you know, making a product like that, you're like, okay, the writing's on the wall that it's getting like harder to keep doing this. And so, you know, sales are slowing down. Like, how long should I keep doing this? And so anyway, I had kind of a like self-reflective moment and said, all right, well, I've got all these components here. I'm going to try to like just kind of keep building things out. And then we're going to kind of see, and then maybe we'll think about like, you know, not building more after a certain point. And I haven't gotten to that point yet, but I'm starting to think about that, which for me is a great run because, I mean, I released that kit in 2011 and now we're in 2024. So lucky 13, I guess.
Yeah. That's almost like as long as the amp hours run. So yeah.
I think that I was working on the kit like around the time that I first started guesting on the show. So that's how long this has been going on.
So we've heard the entirety of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, now it's like, I could say this year, but it's last year. 2023 was kind of a crazy year. We also had our cat who had been sick. I don't know if I've ever mentioned our cat. So we had this cat named Wilson who we adopted when I was living in Austin, right around the time that I designed the Geiger counter kit. So another thing kind of around that time. And he had had a lot of health issues throughout his life, you know, particularly over the past, I would say, like 6 or 7 years. And 2023 was kind of the year that things got really bad with him. And I realized this is a departure from our usual amp hour material, but I was spending like a lot of hours kind of dealing with his care. In particular, he was on like a dozen medications. And I have to say that as an electrical engineer and someone who does electronic kits kind of for a living sometimes, I had like all the tools to like organize and sort pills and like pharmaceutical stuff. And it's really funny because like, you know, I had this entire production line of kind of taking pills that we got from the pharmacy, cutting them up into like little bits, because a lot of them he was on like a quarter tablet or an eighth of a tablet. And then I was sort of having these, like, I was thinking about, okay, how can I be a good pharmacist, basically, because you have to combine pills and put them in pill pockets and do the whole thing. And a lot of it was like things where you need tweezers and you need, and I was like cutting pills using, you know, X-Acto knives and the whole thing. And so anyway, I went from spending probably easily over 10 hours a week kind of dealing with keeping his medications, you know, on hand and doing, and I mean, actually administering the medication and stuff like that. And then December comes and now I don't have to do any of that. And so I'm in this really surreal place where a lot of 2023 I sort of spent working through this, and now I'm sort of past it. And I'm like, man, I have so much time all of a sudden. And so, you know, like I said, I think a lot of people wouldn't have signed up to kind of do what I did. But I have to say that, like, I think that the last year of his life in a lot of ways was his best year. So he pretty much spent the whole summer like in the backyard roaming around, you know, chasing after squirrels, which he couldn't actually catch, but just kind of like living his best life. And it was a like, I will always remember that we sort of got this bonus time with him. And so, you know, 2023 was not a electronics heavy year for me. It was a like dealing with this very, very sick animal that was not at any point sick enough that you're like, all right, we need to call this and like say that this is over, you know, until we got to the very end. But yeah, it was a crazy experience. And now here we are in January, and that's kind of all behind us now, but it was a big focus of last year.
I'm sorry for your loss, man. That's really tough. That's really tough. I think it's, you know, the medical industry generally is a area for lots of innovation and change and stuff like that. But it's just like, it is, once you get into that space, if you're anyone doing long-term care, it's just like, you kind of look around, you're like, why do they do things all these different ways? And yeah. Then like it does it, but then, you know, you get a little bit deeper into it and like the regulation, obviously not, you know, I don't know about veterinary care, but like if you're doing the long-term care for family members and stuff in the human sphere. And it's like, yeah, it's a lot of crazy stuff there.
I think that the things that I was thinking about is like, you know, components, like, you know, we deal with electronic components, but, you know, if you're in the medical world, pills are like components too. And one of the things that I thought was interesting and frustrating as someone kind of this being like a big focus was that, you know, you get these medications and there will be generics. And so like, let's talk about pills. So pills, the same medication can come in a lot of different sizes and shapes of pills, and different generics will have a different diameter, or they'll be film coated, which was kind of my nemesis because I'm trying to divide pills into like eighths of a tablet for this cat. Yeah. But if it's film coated, it's difficult to actually cut up. But like you'll have these substitutions, and it totally reminded me of like my day job, because you would have like, okay, I go to Costco and I fill the prescription, and one time it's like a different pill and you're like, okay, now I'm spending an extra 20 minutes every time I cut up these pills because I have to like deal with the film coating or deal with the fact that now the pill is physically like too big to fit into the little pill pouch that I'm putting it in. And I think it's really interesting that like that's an industry where as a consumer, as like the person who's administering the medication, like they just hand this to you, and they don't even tell you that anything's changed. They don't tell you that, oh, by the way, the pills you've been getting for 6 months, you're never going to see those again because we Costco changed like the provider, you know. And you know, me being me, I'm like, I try to find like the good ones, and it is really hard to like, and I mean, even things like pills have markings on them, and figuring out like what that marking actually means is actually surprisingly difficult for like the end user. And I was really surprised at how not transparent that whole thing is, and how, like, especially with generics, like they can change the, you know, the specific physical properties of the medication you're getting can change, and they just sort of assume you're going to roll with it, which if you're a human and you're taking like a whole tablet, okay, fine. But like, if you're having to like microdose this tablet to like a, you know, a 10-pound cat, it's like a whole nother story.
You know, like substitutions are always a problem, right? For, like you said, for day job or regular, right? I mean, or outside of work. So,
because it's never actually the same, is it?
you know, I mean, there is like some standardization. Yeah. Depends on the, I guess in the electronic space, it's like you at least have some like commoditization, and like, so like two resistor manufacturers are going to have the same, quote unquote, formulation or the same top level spec, right?
Yeah, true.
But I guess one thing I think about with that sort of thing is like, if you are running, you know, you've run high volume lines in the past, right? Mm-hmm, and if you're trying to troubleshoot, then looking backwards at like, you have a new behavior off the line and you're looking backwards, and then you see like, oh, R52 used to be, you know, it used to have a, you know, a 1K0 marking on the top, and now it doesn't. You're going to at least think like that is a problematic space, right? I mean, that's like a problematic thing that could be a area to investigate. But yeah, it's tough when it does switch up, because I mean, that, I don't know, you're just expecting kind of the same thing, unless you have incoming I guess in this case you Jeff playing the role of incoming inspection.
I definitely was, and I think that you know, I would call the pharmacy, and it's like, there's not really any process for that. They're like, well, do you want the medication or not? You can't say, oh, yeah, well, can you change generics for like all of Costco? I feel like that industry, like as like the person at home that's responsible for administering medication, you have like very little resources to like do anything about it. So in a way, I prefer the electronics industry, which you wouldn't think would be like, you'd think that the medical industry would be like more tightly regulated and like this kind of stuff would be less likely to happen. But I actually feel like the electronics industry, I'd way prefer that. Like I can,
yeah, there's like,
you know, you can usually find somebody to call. Whereas like, I don't have pharma reps on my, like, you know, my contact list, right? To say, hey, your enoxaparin came in a weird format this time. Whereas like, if a chip vendor sends you,
I think the other thing though is you get the benefit of like marketplace type things as well, right? Like as long as there is competition, then like you just go with the one that has more, you know. So like if it's the same manufacturer that's changing things, you only have one manufacturer or two manufacturers, like what are you going to do? You basically are like, all right, well, it's kind of like with you in the pharmacy, you're just saying like, all right, I'm just going to go with it, I guess. But like if you have other choices, then you could go and do that, or if you're big enough, you can always go ask them to do that sort of thing. But yeah,
if I had a million cats, I'd probably get a lot more attention, don't you think?
You'd have many, many other problems, Jeffrey.
But I'd have the volume needed to, you know, right, I could get my own custom medications at that point. Maybe not. But still, I kind of went into it with this lens of like being curious about it, because, you know, there is a lot of things about dispensing and about sorting and organizing. And I definitely, you know, those little flip top boxes that like Adafruit, and you can get them on AliExpress for surface mount component storage, like those little,
yeah, those are called pill boxes usually, right? I mean, like, that's,
so I absolutely use those as pill boxes, and they work great. I mean, it's perfect. It's like the perfect thing, and I already had a bunch of them around.
So it
was an adventure.
Sorry about the ending, but sounds like you were quite the steward for your friend. So what about your RF stuff? I mean, so you've been on the show in past years, you know, we've talked about the VNA and things like it. Any of that RF stuff?
So I've been continuing to put together a lab at home to do RF work, and which has been a goal of mine for many, many years. You know, since I was a RF engineer working professionally, I always wished that I had spectrum analyzer, network analyzer, you know, all of that stuff at home. And it took me a long time. And honestly, I still have a ways to go. But over this past year, I rebuilt the step attenuator on the 8753 that I bought from you. And that's been working great. And I've actually used that to do some work with, and it's been really good. And I wish that box was like a third of the size that it is, because it does take up like a big amount of my workbench, but it works great. Yeah, and yeah. I love the 8753 because that's the VNA that I used in college. That's the VNA that I used in my first job and my second job out of college doing RF design. So I can kind of use it with one eye closed, and it's a great VNA. It works really well. Yeah, there's like smaller and better stuff. I demoed a Copper Mountain VNA over the summer.
I think I've seen Shariar review those. Those are like the headless ones.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they basically do everything that an 8753 would do, except it's like a backpack size.
It's like $15,000, isn't it?
Oh yeah, they're really, really expensive. Now I will say they're a good value. Yeah. Personally, I think they're a good value because if you compare it with like the Keysight stuff.
Yeah, but what if you want to play with a CRT screen? Then you don't get to.
Well, you know, I have to say I was skeptical going in, and I'm really glad I did the demo. I know one of the reps, and he reached out, and I was like, yeah, like I will totally get a demo of this. I've been curious about them because, you know, my impression being kind of a test equipment snob was that like there's no way that these are going to be as good as the HP Agilent Keysight stuff that I'm used to, that I've used for, you know, 25 years. But it turns out, actually, I think in some ways they're better. And the fact that they're headless means that you can use like a really nice PC as your CRT.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can more easily like save data and move data back and forth.
That's a big one. Yeah. I feel like, and then scripting too, if you got into scripting, that would be another thing, but
they have a scripting engine.
Yeah.
One of the things that they do that I gave them feedback on is it's really clear if you ever demo the Copper Mountain software is that they're trying to mock up sort of a legacy VNA. Like it looks like an old HP or Rode VNA. And like, I feel like HP kind of pioneered, I'm almost certainly it was HP back in the 1980s or maybe even 1970s, HP kind of created like the soft key user menu interface that all of the VNAs for the past like many, many years have used. And so Copper Mountain pretty much adopted that whole convention, and their UI looks like really similar. So I immediately knew how to use it because you load up the app and you're like, oh yeah, okay. You know, you have to hunt for menus, but like it kind of works the way that I would expect a VNA to work. But on the other hand, that's like kind of limiting because that user interface technology, that convention of UI design was developed like a really long time ago, like probably the 1980s. Yeah. And it hasn't really evolved or changed. And even like new Keysight VNAs, like they kind of look similar in a way, which is kind of shocking almost that like we're still, I guess it was just a really good idea when they developed it and it works really well. But anyway, you know, you're running like a modern PC and it's 2023 and like you load this app and you're like, oh, like it kind of feels like the 80s again.
Yeah.
But it's better because you can start multiple windows and you can have like sessions and the whole thing. So anyway, I demoed this Copper Mountain VNA and it was great. And I actually used it to test the step attenuator that was faulty in the 8753, which was a whole adventure that I went on. I embarked on where I actually took the step attenuator out of the VNA, and anyone that's been around HP RF equipment.
Wait, Jeff, can you explain what a step attenuator is first?
It's an electronically controlled switch that changes the amount of attenuation from port one to port two. So it's a programmable attenuator. It's a thing that you can use to reduce the amount of power going from port one to port two. So if you want to add loss, like say your incoming signal is too big, you can step up and add, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 dB of loss through this switchable device to get your desired signal level at the output. And so VNAs use this because you have a signal source that, you know, in the case of the 8753 goes from, I think it's like 9 kilohertz or 30 kilohertz all the way up to 6 gigahertz. So you have a signal source, which has an oscillator and, you know, amplifiers and the whole thing. But you want that signal source to be adjustable in amplitude so that it's not always at like the max level, which I think is a few dBm for the 8753. You want to be able to actually, so say that you're testing an amplifier and your amplifier has 30 dB of gain, but it has like a relatively low, what's called P1 dB or saturated power output. So your amplifier, it's like a wimpy little amplifier. It can only generate say like 0 dBm before it saturates or starts to distort the signal. You know, that's one of the key metrics for an RF power amplifier. So if you're trying to test it on a VNA, you need to make sure that your input power to the amplifier that you're testing is like really low, because if it's like 0 dBm and the amplifier has 30 dB of gain, well, you're going to be saturating the amplifier because the output can only go to 0 dBm max, but now you have 0 dBm in and then 30 dB of gain. And so it's a mess, right? So that's why VNAs have these really fancy step attenuators. And this is one of the things when people talk about the nano VNA and they talk about like a lot of the low cost, and you know, they're great in a certain context. They're great. Like all the cheap VNAs that you can get that have been out for several years now. But if you look at those VNAs in detail, this is what separates them, among many other reasons or many other kind of characteristics. This is what separates the toys from like the real professional grade VNAs. So the HP 8753 has a step attenuator that I forget if it's like 70 or 90 dB. I think it's 70 dB of total attenuation. So you can have your signal go all the way from like plus 5 dBm, which is, you know, small, but like that's a decent signal. That's a common signal level for RF. But you can switch in all the stages of this step attenuator and go all the way down to, let's say, like minus 70, which is like really low. That's actually hard to measure. It's so low. So you're adding a ton of loss and you're able to get your signal down. But what that does is it allows you to test devices which cannot tolerate larger amounts of input power without distorting or oscillating or being damaged or whatever. And so pretty much any serious VNA has a switchable attenuator. And the ones that are in the HP are a really common design that HP used in a lot of equipment, including signal sources, spectrum analyzers, and a bunch of other RF stuff. And they're, because it's old, they are mechanical devices. So they have solenoids, you know, like a pinball machine. They've got like little solenoids that you can hear like click, 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 click when they're doing their self-test or calibration or you're changing attenuation settings. And those solenoids actually move little gold fingers against these little, I think it's like glass substrates, or they're an insulating substrate that I think is glass that actually has like a printed or etched pad, like a resistive pad on the glass. So they're these little gold fingers that are actually physically moving on plungers up and down so that they either make contact with this resistor basically, or they pull back and they actually short against the housing. So you can either switch the resistor, or it's actually called a pad because it's like a matched resistor. It's not just like a series resistor, but there's parallel components as well. But these little fingers can move up and down. And because these are inherently mechanical devices, like they'll work for, I think like they're rated for millions of cycles, but eventually after time and use, things stop working. Like the fingers get dirty, or the biggest issue that happens is that the O-rings that kind of keep these plungers in the right place, they're made of rubber, which was a poor decision by HP. I guess it's the best that they could do, but the rubber falls apart over time. And then the little bits of O-ring get into these little, like almost watch-like mechanisms, these little tiny fingers that are moving around. And then somebody has to actually take this thing apart and completely break it down into its components, replace the O-rings, put it back together, test it, and then put it back in the instrument. And I actually did that for this step attenuator. And I have to say, I think it was one of the hardest repairs that I've ever done. It was just daunting. Like every aspect of it, it was like taking apart a watch. And then, you know, and that's one of the things that for me, like I'm sitting in my lab, which is in my home, and I'm like, gosh, this place is so dirty. Like it's not a clean room. I'm taking apart this really delicate thing with all these shiny gold surfaces, and I'm like really worried that I've got my windows open because it's the summertime and there's like dirt blowing in and it's dusty. And so I was a little bit nervous that I'd be able to actually pull this off, but I kind of continued and kind of worked through it all, and I took it all apart and I cleaned everything, and I figured out that yes, in fact, the O-rings in the unit that was in your old 8753 had dried up and they were sticking. And so one of the stages was not actually making contact consistently. And if you toggled it, eventually you could sort of get it to make contact, but it wasn't reliable. And after taking it apart, putting it back together, I had to make test fixtures. I had to buy equipment to sort of drive the step attenuator outside of the instrument so I could test it. I put it all back in and it works. And I was so impressed by my success that I actually like went on eBay and I bought a bunch more step attenuators, thinking, okay, well, if this dies again, I'm going to have like another one that I can swap in. And honestly, I haven't gotten to that. They're still all sitting here, but it was actually quite an interesting experience having to go through all of this. And for anybody that's been around HP test equipment, like I know that Shahryar has done this on his show. He's done, and I watched a couple episodes of his show to sort of figure out what needed to be done and to see, because he has some good videos where he shows these things. And there's also some good Google groups and things like that for like resources for learning how to repair these. But anybody that's been around these instruments long enough will encounter this sooner or later, because it's a really common failure and it affects a lot of RF equipment made by HP. And there are probably other brands too, but HP, you know, I have a bunch of HP stuff here. And so knowing how to do this was really important. And there's, I think, pretty much only one or two people in the country that are willing to do this if you want to pay them. And I was like, you know, like I could pay somebody to do this, but I also, I feel like I need to know how to do this so that, you know, if it ever happens again, I'll be able, I'm not going to like pay $400 or whatever every time this happens. And so anyway, I did it. It works.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. That's, it's interesting, like how much stuff in the RF space. I remember when we talked about the APS-C, whatever the connector type is on there.
APC7. Yeah.
APC7. Yeah. Like how, just how critical the spacing is, and obviously the cleanliness, that makes sense. But yeah, like the, just the reliance on it. And like, even when I look at like RF layouts and stuff like that, when you look at like how you create an attenuator on your board, it's just, it is a shape, you know, it's still just like copper or gold on a substrate, but then it's like, it's the shape and the physical nature that ultimately does it. I don't know. Just to me, that always stands out as like a interesting, like kind of not black magic, but just like, it's a different, it feels like it's a different kind of realm of study.
It is. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that it's interesting that electronics in general is sort of headed this way, where the physicality of the implementation matters a lot. Like no one's doing these giant, well, I guess people do all sorts of things, but you think of these big breadboarded electronics things back in the old days with lots of wire and, you know.
Jeff, I have to say, I really don't think about those things anymore. I mean, like if I'm watching like retro tech videos, then yeah, sure. Yeah. But like, you know. Yeah. Yes.
But we're at a point now where signals are fast enough. And but there's also a lot of other considerations that are driving the physical design of electronics, like the packaging. And, you know, if you want to design something like a phone, even if it was at low frequency, you're still in this domain of where the physical aspect, or you have thermal considerations or things like that. But you're exactly
right. Well, I think like the fact that things are moving to direct, you know, silicon to silicon type stuff, or silicon on substrate, and I think the shrinking geometries definitely are impacting a lot of things, and then a lot of the physical things pop out of there. So we had like Andreas Olofsson on again. He was talking about like chiplets and stuff like that, but like the hearing about how it's all put together for an end chip as well, it's like, it kind of, every time I hear about this stuff, it's like, oh, we're just pushing our PCB problems down onto silicon vendors now, right? So like, you know, chiplet type stuff or similar, you know, like any kind of like SIP package that I'm buying off the shelf, anything that looks like a module, I'm like, oh, you're just making that little tiny circuit board for me, and I'm okay with it. There's a Pallav Agarwal, I think his name is. He's got a blog where he does a lot of like RISC-V, like CH32 V003 stuff, but like he does like courses on that. But then he also has been doing module teardowns lately. So like he'll just like rip the can off of like cell modules that he has around, and he's like, oh, let's look at what's in here. I'll put some links in the show. It's cool to look at that. But I'm like, I'm like, nothing is going to change from my perspective. Like, oh, that's a Skyworks RF switch on the front end. Like, oh, does it talk to a cell tower? I don't give a shit otherwise. You know, like that's basically the level that I'm at. I'm just like, well, you know, cell module vendors, you deal with it. And I'll worry about it when it stops working.
You know, I find that fascinating. I think my favorite modules are, Murata has a series of DC to DC converters that have like printed inductors in the module. I always thought those were so cool, where like the laminate of the module is an inductor, and sometimes they'll have like ferrites clamped around them or you know, so that they have better efficiency or whatever it is. I always thought that was awesome, because then I've always kind of felt, I guess I've been kind of a snob about modules, but I've always been resistant to use modules in my designs.
Join the resistance.
Because, you know, you pay more, you're paying there's somebody else that's kind of in the middleman there, right?
Yes,
where
yes.
You know, you're probably getting a package that's like a little bigger than if it was directly integrated. You might not have as much flexibility on the design. Maybe it doesn't do exactly what you want. But in the case of like the Murata thing, they're actually bringing something to the table that is really interesting. And like designing a printed transformer, I'm probably not going to do that. That's outside the scope of like what I'm going to do for a single product. And the other thing I think is interesting about modules is like they'll get the FCC certification. And that's another thing where you're like, okay, yeah, now I totally get it. It totally makes sense to use a module, unless you're doing like a high volume product of yourself where, you know, you can actually pay and have the time to do all that stuff. But yeah, I love those teardowns because it's like it demystifies. Like I've never thought of those things as black boxes because I used to work on modules. I was a module designer, you know, way back when. And so I was the guy putting those little Skyworks switches in front-end modules for cellular. And I just, I've always wanted to know, like, I want to know what's in the box. I want to know what's in there. It's like, how does it work?
Pain. That's what's in the box.
Pain.
Isn't that the line from Doom? What's in the box? Pain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of, shoot, what's the other movie? What's in the box? Late 90s.
Andy Samberg thing about it.
No. No. Seasonally appropriate.
Yeah. No, I think you're right though. And
it's Seven. The movie is Seven.
I never saw Seven. Yeah.
Seven is a scary movie. I do recommend it, but it's a scary movie.
I don't like scary. I don't know how to do scary. No, thank you. I'll pass. None for me, thanks. I think it does depend where you are in your career and what your company pushes for too, right? Like modules probably were the wrong call for like the Steam controller, right? Like, cause it's just like, you should be putting almost like silicon down on the board. You almost were at the level of
exactly.
chip with black blob on top of it, right? Yeah. Like that's almost the level you were at.
And you're making a ton of them and you're extremely cost sensitive.
Yeah.
You cannot be putting other people's modules on your board.
I once went to go talk to a RF group that was in Chicago. And it was like a quasi interview, and you know they were talking about like they were super legit, like they knew all their stuff, and they're like talking about like all their customers they had worked for and doing chip down design for like cellular stuff on like onto PCBs, and then they would do the full FCC, then you have to do a full FCC thing, and they're like, yeah, I just don't know why anyone would ever do a module or anything like that. And they're like, all right, Chris, you said you brought some demos. Like, what did you bring? And then I bring out this board and it's got like a honking huge Quicktel module. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm one of the module users. Turns out I didn't get the job, nor did I want it. But different strokes for different folks, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah. I think one of the big things there is that you could get yourself into sourcing trouble, right? Like modules.
Oh yeah.
There's no like standardization. Yeah. Even though it would be a perfect place to do it, none of the module vendors are like, oh yeah, I'll make the same thing my competitor does. Like we are completely unimportant in this process. Please let us battle on price with one another.
Yeah. It's 100%. And it's really hard to do substitutions. It's really hard to have multiple sources. I think you're quite vulnerable to the module vendor. And I think that for certain designs, it's fine. I mean, I've also seen you've got products that start out modular because you can get to market quicker. And then, obviously you got to design it out and kind of come up the learning curve. And maybe we could have done that on the controller. I don't know. We went from 0 to 100 really fast.
Yeah.
But like we certainly prototyped with modules.
I mean,
that was the
Which
easiest
is the right,
way to
right
get
place
a,
to do it.
And
sure.
NRF radio, like back in the day, there were a bunch of companies that were making low cost modules. And so, you know, stick one of them on a board. But I was always keen to sort of get all that stuff out because I also
you wanted to
like,
get the RF fiddly bits and optimize, I'm sure.
Well, I did enjoy that quite a bit.
I've this many Kaiser misses. You don't do this many Kaiser misses and not know a little bit more about Jeff.
Yeah.
Not only do we hang out at Kaiser misses, you and I hung out in person this year. That's something that happened in 2023. We didn't mention that.
Yeah, that's true. So actually, what that was like August?
July.
When was that?
That was July. Yeah.
July. Yeah.
That was on our.
That was super cool. You came during like the best 3 months of the year here in Seattle. So you have like a really inaccurate
yes.
view.
Yeah, what's it like there now?
Life is like, this is what we call the big dark. I don't know if I've seen the sun in a while. This is the time of year when it gets like dusk is at, you know, 3:30.
Oh, yeah, this is basically Seattle as a Nordic country.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. This is what gives Seattle its reputation and, you know, why people always are hesitant to, you know, move here or come visit here. It's like this time of year, I remember every year, you know, the first year we moved here being like really shocked at how early it gets dark. And, you know, you go to work and it's dark, and then you come home and it's dark. And you, I think after a few years, you crack or you like embrace the darkness. And, you know, I have to say, I don't love it, but I'm fine with it. Like, it's just a feature of,
well, that's the thing about being a nerd inside your lab all day and all night. I know this about the sun here, Jeff. I don't see the sun most days.
So yeah, it's also rainy, which, you know, fits the other stereotype of Seattle. So like, I would definitely recommend if someone's visiting Seattle, you definitely don't want to come now, although hotels are probably cheap. Mm. And, you know, I mean, especially now that Christmas and stuff is over. But yeah, it's the time that you were here. Those are our best months. There's this kind of saying in Seattle is that the 4th of July through Labor Day, which is not that many weeks.
Yeah.
That's sort of the reliably like good weather. And often the weather is incredible during that period. Yeah. And you were here kind of right during that time. And it was really cool. It was good to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually my wife and I figured out this year that like, so we lived in Chicago for a long time and I lived in many other cold places. And the thing is like, you shouldn't leave in the summer then, right? You shouldn't like go travel then, but you always want to because you have friends other places and, you know, you want to go see national parks or whatever. And it's a bad time. Like Chicago in the summer is fantastic, just like Seattle is, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like,
yep.
But now we live somewhere where your face will melt off in the summer, and we're like, oh yeah, we can get the heck out of here in the summer. We should do that. And so we'll be doing that more.
My wife and I have an unofficial rule that we will not travel during those weeks of July 4th to Labor Day. Like, I think if you live in Seattle, it's like you need to have some rules about like, okay, we're not gonna miss like the best time of year here. And so, you know, like, just like the winter and the spring are, I think, the times to like go to Hawaii or go somewhere else.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Just no big deal. Just pop on over, right? Yeah.
You know, as you do.
Shorter hop for you than me, huh?
Oh, that's definitely true. You would go the other way. You'd go to the Caribbean.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
If I was to do that sort of thing, yes, I would. Oh man, how about your mechanical? I mean, you had been doing, I mean, car stuff is kind of feels like that's a nonstop for you, but like I remember you were doing CAD stuff, not last year, but I think 2 years ago you were doing CAD stuff. Well, I guess I should look at show notes.
Yeah, I was learning SolidWorks. So I still do use SolidWorks.
You do want to switch to FreeCAD? I have FreeCAD open on my screen in front of me right now. Not actively, but it's a hot pile.
So I made a conscious effort to learn SolidWorks, and I'm not leaving the SolidWorks ecosystem because I don't have enough like bandwidth or desire to like become multilingual in the mechanical CAD space. Like, I really just wanted to become good at SolidWorks because for years and years and years when I was at Valve, I wanted to be able to do things in SolidWorks, and I was so bad. Like, I was embarrassingly terrible at doing, because we had all these 3D printers at work, and I was like, well, I need to ask somebody else to like help me.
The secret of 3D printing is it doesn't matter a lick unless you know how to model. Like, it just doesn't, it's not,
yes.
You're basically
yes.
getting trinkets that would be much cheaper to get from China, you know, like, or, you know, maybe you can customize them a little bit, but who cares?
I've definitely gotten to the point where I can need something, throw together some CAD for like an enclosure, or for a lot of times it's like really simple stuff like spacers, adapters, things like that, like little fixtures.
Yeah, but that's something where like even that would be tough to go and get from like a hardware store, right? I mean, like,
oh yeah,
I feel like that's where it really comes through that I'd never thought would be a thing, but it definitely is.
And I think that for me, one of the big hangups is I would try to go into CAD wanting it to be like perfect and these really good designs that are like done according to best practices. But what I've learned is that I'm actually much better at saying, okay, My goal is to just get to the printed part working and fitting, mm-hmm. and then we can worry about all that other stuff later and just try to like get in and not be too rigid in how I do the CAD. And with SolidWorks, it's interesting because I think it's like a lot of those 3D modeling programs. There's like 10 different ways to do something. And mm-hmm. there's usually like a way that probably people that do it every day are like, well, you should really use this tool. You should use the spline tool and not this other tool.
Yeah, right.
But I'm kind of going in saying, actually, yeah. So I go in saying, well, I'm aware that I'm just being like fast and loose. I'm not like, you know, doing the right hierarchy of features, things like that. But like, let's just get the part that it's the right size, it functions, it works. And then let's figure out the rest later about symmetry and things like that. And I've gotten much better this year at being faster and loose so that I can sort of just get to the result quicker, you know, especially the first result to say, is this part even what I want? Like, does it fit? Is it the right size? Does it function the way that it should? And so anyway, I've been doing quite a bit of that. I still have a 3D printer here. So I've been doing some CAD and then I'll, you know, send it over to the 3D printer and I haven't been like following trends. So I still have the Prusa Mark III S that I've had for, I think I built it in 2019 and then I've been like upgrading it a couple times.
Yeah.
So I'm not on like the bleeding edge.
Did you get the upgrade for the, what's it called? The Mark IV got it for sure.
No. And the Mini got it. I don't have the new extruder. And I don't have the acceleration thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
No, I don't have any of that stuff. So I'm kind of behind the curve now, but I also like, I know my printer really well.
Input shaper. That's what it's called.
Input shaping. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is trippy as shit. Like that is like the best firmware update I've ever gotten for a device the most visible, like on a device that I'm actually modifying versus like unlocking a new mode in like a camera. Maybe I guess that's probably big as well, but input shaping.
So do you have a Mark IV or a Mini?
I have a Mini. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Highly recommend a Mini. Like cost, you know, if you're not, most people aren't building things like they think they will, like the size of things. People always, including myself, I way overestimated. So like my first printer was 200 by 200 by 300 millimeter or 8x8x12 inches, which is insanely big, right? I did not need that. And it was, you know, it was a kit and I just didn't need that. It was like made to build lots of big things with low resolution. And it's like, no, I want probably more resolution. Input shaping is like basically everything speeds up. It's crazy. I'll post a Thomas Sarlander video in here too. It's not the most glowing video about it, but just like seeing the difference, the speed difference is jarring.
I can't do it because my printer has the old 8-bit controller. So it would need to do a lot of surgery.
Got it.
I think that there's a Mark IV upgrade kit, but then you have to change your extruder and I've already got all these nozzles for the old one.
You should you should just refresh if you ever wait until you need to.
I've always thought that I would just keep this printer and then just have another printer, which is the new one, you know. But I haven't really had a need to upgrade.
I think it's the other thing. You said like spacers, like how much time, what is your average print time too? That's the other thing. You know, like
it varies
like
wildly.
An hour?
But
who cares?
No, I mean, it depends. One of the things I did this year is I started experimenting with really small nozzles. And so I went down to a 0.25, which I'd been using like a 0.4, which I think the standard has been 0.6 and 0.4. I started wanting to print like really tiny stuff, particularly for repairing Tektronix. I have a bunch of TM500 modules, which is a line of test equipment that Tektronix did, which is...
What's the name again?
It's TM500. So it's a series. Okay. So Tektronix back in the 1980s had these modular test equipment things. I think it was a great idea.
Were these
idea.
The ones that like... They were like the long, skinny modules? Like,
yes.
Like what's the relative size on these things for people can get a feel?
Oh, they're like at least 12 inches long, and then they're probably like 2 or 3 inches wide, and then 3 or 4 inches tall. Yeah. So it's like a rectangular prism, and I'd say they're like way too long because like the main
step,
frame that they go into is like a bench. Yeah, it totally is like a bench depth issue, and so that's one of the things I did this year is I upgraded my lab and I got like workbenches, which I bought at University Surplus for pennies on the dollar. Ooh. But then I ended up spending several times that to get shelves for them because I had to buy them from this one company that makes like the workbench
just like
shelves.
Modules.
So anyway, I upgraded to like 15 inch deep shelves because of this TM500 yep. stuff, which is kind of deep. Yep.
This is another reason for headless stuff too. I feel like just the depth requirement on a bench is insane. It's really crazy.
Yeah, my buddy Tony was telling me that there's a new who makes it. There's a new oscilloscope that goes on a monitor arm, which is a
like
great,
a Visa mount.
Great idea.
Yeah,
that I really like.
I mean, every scope is basically like LCD front end chip. Big zinc processor slash FPGA and like, all right, you're done. You know, and obviously there's a lot more than that, but power supply, it's like, you know, like watch, you know, EV blog reviews or something like that. And like, you'll see them, you know, like that's, there's not much, they're getting smaller and smaller. And then a big ass fan on the back.
Yeah. It's true. So this TM500 stuff is, I think it's a great idea because what it does is it allows you to have like a power supply and then you can plug in various modules to do like signal generator, multimeter, and also like interesting stuff. Like I have one that is an op amp. It's just an op amp and it's got terminals on the front and you can put a resistors across the terminals or you can put on a board to like make it into an integrator or a differentiator or an adder or whatever. And it's a really clever idea. And I think like Tektronix kind of got, they had some fun when they were designing the modules because they did some like interesting stuff. There's, you know, power supplies and there's all sorts of kind of somewhat specialized calibration fixtures and stuff. But one of the things almost universally is that this was a great idea, but it was implemented kind of poorly because I think it was done in a division of the company that didn't have the resources and the budget that like oscilloscopes did. And so, like if you look at them, the build quality is not on par with like some of the really nice scopes from the same time period, at least in my experience. Yeah. And I think this is a thing people talk about.
Could have been like they got pushed to a different factory even too, right? Or like secondary lines, stuff like that. Like you're not the A squad, you know? Like you're not the money maker. So yeah.
And I'll say, you know, there's some great design work and I'm sure some great people worked on these, but like it definitely has that kind of B team flavor. And the reason I really say that is that anyone who's ever collected these modules knows that the vast majority of them that you buy today are broken. Like they are horrible in terms of reliability. I think mainly because tantalum capacitors and electrolytic capacitors fail. Like they used poor quality components and they're also really old because a lot of these modules from the 70s, 80s, 90s, I think. And so anyway, if you buy a bunch of TM500 stuff, a word of warning is that it's like, a lot of it, probably over half of what I've encountered is broken in some way. Like, and it's always annoying stuff. It's like these selector switches that have like these cam switches with 100 positions and like they're really complicated and really hard to work on. And so anyway, I've started printing some little parts and everything's like really small because they're these little kind of highly integrated little modules. And so I switched to a 0.25 nozzle on the 3D printer this year and I started printing little brackets and replacement parts for them. Because I had to get these modules working. I'm trying to like get a test setup working so that I can repair. I'm in this like trap, which I think is probably familiar to people that are into electronics, that have been into electronics for a long time, that you like buy a piece of equipment, it doesn't work. And you're like, okay, I have to buy three other pieces of equipment so that I can repair this first piece of equipment. I'm probably like six stages down that now to where I have a lot of broken equipment. And the TM500 stuff, I'd say, is among the most broken. It's like I have a pile of it. It all needs a ton of work, like tons of work to get it all working.
Kaiser-Miss 2024 is actually going to be an intervention. Jeff, but we're all here also, and we love you and we think you have a problem. And we have that same problem, but you have the most of the problem.
So I remember I'm probably like a broken record if you play my episodes back to back, because I remember talking about this last year because I was also in this like TM500 hell last year. And one of the things that I said last year, and I'll repeat it again, and then I won't repeat other things from last year, but I think repairing test equipment is a great way to learn about electronics design and about test equipment design, obviously. But I have to say that, you know, a year later, it's like really rewarding. And it's also really, really, really hard, like really hard, especially because now we're at a point where this equipment is all really old and you can't call up Tektronix and get parts for it anymore, which is like a huge problem. Like,
yeah, you're basically we're into the realm of like Jay Leno in his garage, like 3D printing a boiler for like a 1910
car. Yeah, where you're trying to repair the turbine car, and you have to make your own turbine.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're just like doing it off of like a Polaroid photo.
Yeah,
watching his videos that stuff's amazing. Like his shop is amazing, but like
Have you seen the turbine car one?
No.
So there's a documentary by Haggerty. It's on YouTube. It's by Haggerty Drivers Foundation. It's called "The Chrysler Turbine Car: Engineering a Revolution."
I think I've seen an ad for the car when it came out. I've definitely seen a video about the car, but not about the repair. Because it was like a jet, right? I mean, like, but it was...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Chrysler, I think it's in the 1960s, made a turbine-powered car, and they made a whole bunch of prototypes.
Maybe we talked about this on the show last year, too.
Ooh, that would be scary.
I should really look at this. All right, you keep going. Maybe that's the documentary I'm thinking about, Jeff.
So they made a turbine car. They gave them to a bunch of people to test drive them and get feedback. And then after this program was done... It was too complicated and too expensive, and they ended up taking all the cars back and then destroying the vast majority of them. But Leno has one, and he has gone through tremendous hoops to keep it on the road, because he actually burned up the engine or the turbine, and then literally had to like contract with the design team that originally did the turbine. Like some of those guys are still alive.
Yeah.
And I apologize if I talked about all this last year. It's entirely possible that I did.
I definitely watched parts of this video. I remember seeing, I think it was about the high level car thing though. Maybe it was, I don't know.
So he's having these guys like make new parts, and test equipment is definitely getting to be, I mean, if you think about it, like, it's now 2024 and a lot of this equipment is like, you know, 40 years old. So, I mean, that's a long time to try to be keeping things alive. And one of the things that I think is challenging is that test equipment, like if this was the 1980s and you were repairing stuff from the 1940s, it would be simple. It would be simple.
The scale differences of like,
what... the complexity and the amount of like special modules and custom ICs and stuff. Like in the 1940s, you didn't have custom ICs. You didn't have ICs in general. But now that it's 40 years ago is putting us in the 1980s. Now we're at the point where like there's a bunch of proprietary weird stuff in these, and they're built to like a different build standard. And so it's actually getting much, much harder. I've got a bunch of old tech oscilloscopes, and you know, you look at the ones made in the 70s and then you look at the ones made in the 80s, and like just in 10 years, the complexity went through the roof. You've got like switching power supplies and all this stuff in the newer ones.
Yeah.
And that makes them much harder to service. But it's still rewarding, and I think it's super interesting. And it's, you know, there's definitely the satisfaction of repairing something with other equipment. And yeah, I probably talked about all of this last year.
No, you didn't. I'm looking right now, Jeff. You didn't. I'm also going through my art, and I'm very proud of myself for...
For the Kaiser Miss art?
All the Kaiser Miss art. It's very badly photoshopped, but I got all of the Christmas movies that I love. I think I got a couple of, pretty great. Pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good times with Kaiser Miss. Yeah, no, we didn't talk about this last time, apparently. So I must have just watched this on my own, or maybe you sent me a link or something like that. A lot more. I think last year was a lot more ham stuff.
Oh, yeah. And I've been doing ham stuff this year, too.
Nah, we did ham stuff last year. Don't worry about it. I like test equipment stuff better.
You like test equipment better. Well,
yeah. I mean, I think so.
The things, they kind of all come together. It's all... can use ham equipment as test equipment.
I mean, it's all going to be the pinnacle of you. Like, do you have, has your beard grown out yet? Like, is it long and gray yet? I mean, I know it's gray.
Well, it's certainly gray.
Yeah,
it's getting super gray.
Yeah, totally.
It's not long, but it's super gray. Yeah. It shocks even me.
Well, that's the thing. You remember when it wasn't gray. So that's,
oh yeah.
That's always the problem.
No, I definitely, I definitely remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still 25 in my mind, and then I go for a walk, and I'm like, oh wow, my hip hurts, and I'm like, oh yeah, no, I'm not 25. I'm actually yeah. in my 40s. So, yeah.
I'm working on being Santa. That's you know.
You mean you're jolly and generous? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I'll certainly be gray bearded and round. Yeah. Round. I can work on the jolly. Round. I'll work on the jolly part.
Yeah. 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 What do you what do you see for the new year? What's on your plate now? I mean, obviously you said you're scheduled a little more freed up, but not for good reasons, but for reasons.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I have more time on my hand.
What are you hoping to do?
Well, I think that kind of one of the things that I've been trying to do this past year, but I think I'll be putting more effort into, is reducing the amount of test equipment that I have.
And, so eBaying things, yeah.
Oh, I mean, yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I've started
pushing off on some other poor sucker.
Well, one of the things that I've done on eBay that's actually interesting. So I will say that my standards are usually pretty high. So if I'm selling stuff on eBay, it's usually like pretty nice. But one of the things I have started doing recently on eBay is, so in the process of repairing an instrument, I'll have to make a custom part, and I'll say, okay, well, I could just make one, but a lot of times it's easier to just make 10 or 20 or 30 parts. Mm. And so one of the things I started doing is saying, okay, as I'm going, and this is kind of part of my way of saying, okay, I need to try to get some money back out of this hobby. You know what I mean? Because yeah, it's like, yeah. it's collecting test equipment. You're not going to like make a lot of money doing this. I promise you. Yeah. But one of the things I started doing is like laser cutting fan filters for vintage, especially oscilloscopes. But like, I have this old tech scope. It needed a new fan filter. It's the little foam thing that goes in the back of the scope that keeps dust and dirt and hair from getting into the scope, you know, because it has a fan on the back.
Yep.
And so I was like, okay, I'm going to design this little thing for mine. And then, oh, well, I have a sheet of this material, and especially on the laser cutter, you know, once you do one, you might as well do like a whole bed full of them. Right. And so I cut a bunch of them and I started selling them on eBay, and it's actually been pretty, like, I've sold a lot of them actually.
Interesting.
And I've been doing this for a couple months now.
Do you find out how people are finding you?
This one I posted to the TechScopes mailing list, which is very active. That's a Google group groups.io. And that, like, anybody who's repairing tech equipment is on that list. It's one of the better, and it's actually, I wish that HP had a list that was as active. And there is actually an HP Agilent mailing list, but the Tektronix community for vintage test equipment repair is so incredible. Like, they just have their act together. I don't know what it is. I think culturally, like, there's a museum for vintage tech equipment, right? Yep. Which, like, there's no museum for HP. Like, I can't, I'm a huge fan of HP equipment. I have a lot of HP equipment, but there isn't this like energy.
No, I think probably HP. There was like a committee put together. And they're like, well, should we put together a place where we can get all of our equipment into one big room? And like, no, we have Jeff's house.
No. Maybe. But I mean, I'm a little jealous of the tech side. I mean, it's just, I think culturally, Tektronix, I think, was an incredible company, had an incredible and like very strong culture. And HP maybe did too, but like, for whatever reason, now that it's 2024, like, we have a vintage tech museum, we don't have a vintage HP museum, we don't have a vintage LaCroix museum, we don't have like a Fluke. Like, Fluke is based in Everett, which is actually, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the show, but Fluke's first Pacific Northwest headquarters was within walking distance of my house. And I know the building that it was in, and I've driven by the building dozens of times before I realized that it was Fluke's. And it's not well advertised. Like, Fluke doesn't really talk about it. They sort of say, our first office in Seattle, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
but like, they never give you the address. They don't actually tell
you. Yeah, because it's not theirs anymore, right? That's the other thing. They don't want you to hassle it's not like a historic site, so they don't want you to like go and like knock on the door and be like, oh,
well, it is a historic site, but
it's not a marked historic site. How about that? It's not like a tourable.
True. Yeah. There's no plaque on the wall.
Same thing. Keith Lee was like that too. They didn't publish the address because it was also a rough neighborhood, I think.
So anyway, isn't it interesting that like Fluke does not have, you know, Tektronix just has this like crazy energy around their history, and they've got people. Like, the thing about the Vintage Tech Museum is that if you go to the Vintage Tech Museum, you will most likely meet people who like worked on and designed the instruments that are in the museum, which is like another whole level. Like, that totally blows my mind. Like, I've met the guy who designed the high performance amplifiers that are in like a scope that I have, and it's just like, wow, like that's incredible. I mean, I could only wish that, like, when I'm long retired,
well,
that,
Jeff,
like,
AI hasn't started designing stuff yet, so, you know, we still get to meet the humans.
Well, no. I mean,
I know what you meant. I know exactly what you meant.
But, like, think of it. You can't that's not like a very novel thing. Like, it's not like you can walk up to the designer of like the Macintosh and like shake his hand and say, hey, nice job, guy. Whereas at the tech museum, you can do that. And I think it's because, you know, maybe it's part of what you said where Tektronix, it's not like a company that has such notoriety that like people are knocking down the door, like trying to get in. It's not like it's not like baseball star or like movie star.
Definitely not
level.
Like that. Yeah.
It's not like you don't have kind of this public fandom that would ruin that, right? So you can have these guys that can come into this museum and they can volunteer and they're not being overrun by like fans, but you do get that opportunity as an engineer.
Does sound like if you
to
go
be
there
a,
that
to be a fan,
maybe they would be
polite about it. Yeah. Well, I think that the interesting thing about going to a museum like that is that when you go there, they do try to like size you up because, you know, if you wander in and you start kind of touching knobs, they're like, oh, like, you know, who are you? Who's this guy?
I see.
But it's like, if you talk to them for a few minutes, they're like, oh yeah, you're an electrical engineer. Oh yeah. You have a bunch of this stuff. Like, you're fine.
It's the shibboleth.
And they've always been like super, super, super friendly and super nice. But as I was saying, so I just started making these parts, and I'll keep this short.
Don't you bring it back to the point on me. The point here is to meander, sir.
Well, I started making these parts, and I started selling them on eBay, and it's not like this big business, but it is something that sort of, I get a lot of satisfaction out of being like, all right, I'm contributing, trying to keep this stuff alive, because I do think this equipment is really important.
Well, there are like, you know, you go through eBay and it's just like super, super niche stuff like this, right? And it's like someone selling it for like $4 and then, you know, plus shipping, whatever. And it's like, that's the right price for that sort of thing. I don't know how much you're selling yours for, but like, it shouldn't be super expensive. And yet it's so niche that you're like, almost like, well, that should be like $30, right? But you know, it's people like you that are doing the same thing.
Well, don't forget who you're selling this stuff to. You're selling this stuff to like retired people. And I don't think those people have a ton of money to,
Jeff,
you
the
know,
price is the price
parts.
Is the price. You get to charge whatever you want to charge. It's just whether or not they're going to buy it,
You may or may not sell any.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, my interest is, and it's kind of, this is the classic example of, you want to make this part, you have to buy an entire roll of material to make this
part. Yeah, I think
part.
That's
so
the right.
So why not just try to pay for the roll? You know what I mean?
And that is the
maybe
goal,
you make a couple bucks.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of the level that I'm at. So I'm not going to make a lot of money, but it is a great thing to get some satisfaction.
And you're already set up to ship. I think that's another big one, right? A lot of people, I was scared of shipping for so long. And I remember Dave would talk about it. And I think you would talk about it a little bit. And I was just like, I don't want to do this. And then like, I finally got a label printer, figured out ShipStation. I'm like, oh, this is like really easy now. And it is, but it was such a big hurdle for me.
And I think it is for a lot of people. I go to the post office like multiple times a week. I have a PO box. I spend quite a bit of time at the post office, and especially this time of year.
I don't want to brag.
No.
Good thing Jeff's married. Can you imagine Jeff bragging about this on a first date and be like, well, I do have a P.O. box.
Where do you like to...
I go to the post office multiple times a week.
I've been at the post office once or twice in my day. So I agree with you that it is a big hurdle because I go to the post office, especially around this time of year,
and
you run into a lot of people waiting in like really long lines that look very sad to be waiting in those lines. And when I have to wait in those lines, I'm really sad that I'm waiting a line because my entire goal of dealing with the post office is never to wait in line.
No, you're dropping the bin. Right? That is the best case thing.
So I even like go to the post office that has the best drop-off situation,
the window,
so that I don't have to interact with anyone. Literally the window that you throw the package into. So this is I'm going to jump a little bit because in terms of like shipping things, as someone who buys stuff on eBay, people are very, very, very bad at shipping things. Like your average person who, especially the types of people who have vintage equipment or especially like CRT monitors and televisions, like you hear horror stories. Yeah. I mean,
no way.
So I don't know where you've been, but like CRT monitors are like super collectible now, and it's getting to the point where, No. It's like, I mean, I don't, this isn't like a mainstream hobby, but there's definitely this growing group of CRT collectors that are...
Wait a second, though. Wait, are you talking about computer monitors?
It's televisions and computer monitors, both. No. Anything with a CRT. Oh, no, this is a huge thing. Don't, like, throw away CRTs, because now they're worth money. And, I mean, some are probably not worth money, but...
Why? Do people want the little, like the turn-on, like, the warm-up blink?
They're huge. Same reason people want collector cars. Like, it's different. They are in obsolete technology. They're complicated. They get hot. They're interesting.
I think
at the end of the day, the reason that people want them is that they have very low latency compared to LCD-based displays. So the signal that goes in gets immediately within the latency of the electrical signal propagating up to the tube. So like nanoseconds, they display what you've provided. And LCDs inherently do not do that, because LCDs update on a frame-by-frame basis. So you don't instantaneously see the change on the input. So...
Yeah, but what about the scan lines? You know, you got to do that too, right?
Well, so CRTs have scan lines. And so actually aesthetically, they do look different. And people like fetishize this in a way that actually makes me kind of uncomfortable.
Is it becoming like tubes? Is this like how like people do this with like audio, like tubes as
well? Oh, yeah. No, it is actually kind of getting weird. Like that. Like people know like, oh, Sony had this particular...
The best phosphors.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or had like... what is it called? Like the grid mask, the shadow mask. I'm not inherently a CRT guy. So like, Sony had like these special technology, these things that they used to make CRTs that made Trinitron displays different.
I remember that brand name for sure.
I had a Trinitron in college and it probably weighed 70 pounds. Oh, it was a 19 inch Trinitron.
Remember LAN
monitor.
Parties and like how people would bring you know, like they would all just like come over with their huge ass tower computers and
and their giant CRTs.
Like,
so now,
oh, you got
I mean,
a 23 inch CRT, like, and it's like basically like moving a house, you know.
They were really, really large. Yeah, and so, terrible. You know, obviously, as soon as LCDs came out, everyone got rid of their CRTs because they were like awful in a lot of ways. They took up a lot of space. They were really heavy. They were hot. You know, the image quality for computers was not super great, right? Because pixel density was low and they're kind of fuzzy and, you know, refresh rates weren't what they are today. So anyway, now we've had enough time that we can become nostalgic for those things. And I think in particular, the vintage computing and vintage like video gaming communities are like really, really active. Like that's a huge thing. Like anything from the 80s, 90s, even 2000s, there's a lot of like Nintendo, Super Nintendo.
So like I
want to
play
Jazz
Jackrabbit on a CRT with like a X286 or something like that.
Yeah, it is.
That's like my childhood.
I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia for like 486s and 386s and like PCs, which
I want to hear that.
You know, totally.
Sound.
Yeah, like Commander Keen on like your 486 DX. There are Commander Instagram channels or whatever accounts that are sharing like the sound of the hard drive spinning up and the clicking of the switches. And I mean, it's so funny how like everything gets like kind of fetishized in this modern day, right? Like it's all ASMR. It's all like, you know, all this stuff. So CRTs are kind of part of that whole thing. I think they're cool because they have low latency and also because it's just different. It's like, oh, if you're going to play an original Nintendo, it should be on a CRT. If you play it on an LCD, it's like fundamentally different.
Oh, well, another reason to do that is you actually can't, we had an old Nintendo here and an N64 and I was like, oh, my TV's got AV component input, right? Like I can just plug directly into it. Nope. It can't drive that big of a screen. It won't do it. Mm. And there's no compatibility mode to like handle Nintendo's and handle the signals coming in. So I'm like,
probably because it doesn't like 480i.
Yeah. it's something
like
that.
Really low resolution.
And it was like to the point where I'm like, all right, well, I basically spun up a Raspberry Pi arcade, whatever it's called, not the main thing, but it was just like so much easier to just go and emulate and I'm done. And I don't
care. Retro Pi,
that's
right?
The one. Yep,
yeah. Yep. And those have been really popular. I've never built a Retro Pi, but this is like, kind of like when you walk up to an old arcade game, like the big stand-up arcade games that you'd have at an arcade, like it has to be a CRT. It's like really a big part of the aesthetic. It's like you can't have like a pinball machine that's like a TV screen instead of a pinball machine. It's like different. People do it. Some people are into it. I'm not, but like that's a thing people do. But for me, it's like very important that it, you know, it behaves like the way that it did when it was new. You know, like it always has.
Right. Yeah, I think so, you're right about
that. Same thing for video games.
The childhood kind of piece of everything. Yeah, it's just, it definitely is, it's because people, you know, I think just the age of when people were growing up, we're in that part of the, it's not like the hype cycle, it's the opposite of the hype cycle, right? But it's basically nostalgia building and then how people have already
90s,
trashed all their old stuff.
The 90s are, yeah, I totally agree with that. The 90s are super in right now. And I think that there's this thing where there you could plot this on a graph of like, yeah, you time goes by and then you get to a point where, oh, I'm going to get rid of all this garbage from the 90s that I have because like all the new stuff is way better. And like, why do I have all this stuff around? So these fads wait until everyone has given all their stuff to Goodwill or has thrown away all of their 90s stuff. And then all of a sudden, and I really feel like this has intensified over the past year, especially, all of a sudden we get like intensely nostalgic for the 90s. And it's crazy to see 90s nostalgia everywhere. But someone was saying that like, if you made the movie Back to the Future today, you'd go back to what, 1995, which is what?
The Zubas would be out of control.
We are in peak nostalgia, so hang on to those CRTs or make sure that they go to a good home, because there are folks that are
break them with a
looking
with a baseball
for
bat, just like everybody else does.
I'm gonna bring it back again. Gonna bring it back to where we were in our meandering path. So the reason why this matters is that people are really bad at shipping things, especially CRTs, because they don't see that was a good meander. So far
serpentine,
that I almost didn't know how to get it back again. Like people, especially eBay, they'll take the CRT, throw it in a box where it's like touching the sides of the box, you know, put some tape on it. No, literally, there's like hundreds and hundreds of examples of this happening, and then ship it and just, you know, hope and pray.
It's like getting anthrax by like phosphors, you know, when you open the box, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is actually dangerous. You get broken glass. And like phosphor is probably not good for you. No. So you've got all these CRTs that arrive broken. And I think it's because there's a segment of the population that they think that as soon as they like close the box, that like whatever happens in the box, it's now okay.
Magic.
It's going to make it. It's like, I don't see what's
CRT.
Schrodinger CRT. As long as I don't see the CRT in the box, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I've seen this many times with buying test equipment where your average Joe does not know how to package test equipment, like doesn't know how to wrap things and protect them and to put them in a sturdy box where it's not like falling apart.
I have to be honest. I question how often I'm buying stuff that is known and or legally owned by the person I'm buying from. I'm not saying I buy stolen goods, but like
you buy like power tools on eBay all
the
time.
No, like power
tools. Craigslist or Facebook
Marketplace. So here's the thing. Like, so I bought my Mini, Prusa Mini on eBay, right? It was pandemic. It was like 6 month waiting time. I don't want to wait. I needed a printer. I was like, all right, I can just go buy this on eBay. But like, you know, it was an unopened box on eBay. And then like, it was a little bit of a risk. It wasn't too big of a premium, but I'm like, someone could have just snatched this off a porch, right? You know, like that's the real thing I think about. It's like porch pirates. Like that's not a small amount of things that are going to be sold. And like, I don't have any way to know, you know, I hope not, but
I think certain product categories are way more likely to have this. Like, and I noticed this as a seller on eBay too, that certain things, when you sell them, you kind of get like a different crowd. Like if I'm selling a piece of test equipment, it's fine. Generally, I've never really had issues. I mean, because
someone
it's like
buying
people
your
like,
Techscope, you're like, oh, you have the same problem I do.
I think literally, yes. Like that is, it's an enthusiast community, and if you're looking for like a Tech 465
addict community, Jeff, it's you have a problem.
Okay, but then
we're here. We love you. You have a problem. You need to stop.
I appreciate that. But then you change it a little bit. So say you're not selling like a weird old Techscope, but you're selling like a 1960s generic cheap oscilloscope, you know, like an RCA or an Enco or something like that. So there's all these like kind of cheap tube scopes from the 60s that show up all over on eBay. And you can actually get like a decent amount of money for them now. And I realize that the reason that those scopes sell well, as a person who has sold several of them.
Let me guess, they're going in like the background of music videos to like look sciency.
Well, that's a good idea. Is a good idea. No, it's people that want to do the whole oscilloscope music thing where you hook your computer up to a scope and you can do pretty pictures. And there's like a whole whole movement around that, but the kind of folks that are doing that, they care a lot more about the aesthetic quality of like the front panel of the scope. And there's a lot of old Heathkit and RCA and Co. scopes that are gorgeous, but they're horrible oscilloscopes. Terrible. Like their bandwidth of like 100 kilohertz, like they're like really? They have like very bad you know, they're just bad, like they're bad oscilloscopes. They're the kind of scopes that have like six tubes inside them and that's it, and like you can't do very much with six active devices, right? So they're garbage oscilloscopes by any modern definition, but they look really cool, and I've sold a bunch of them that I've picked up at swap meets, because I have no interest in keeping that kind of stuff around, even though it's very pretty to look at, because it's not functional. You can't, you're not going to test anything with it.
Right.
But I've sold a bunch of patience. Them on eBay. And it's funny because the kind of questions you get and the people that are wanting them are, you know, like kids. It's like, you know, kids. People who clearly, like teenagers, like that want to do this cool thing because this is a cool thing to do. So it's not like you're Tektronix collector, because like a 465 or like an old Techscope, those are worth a lot more money because they are usable as oscilloscopes.
You know what you should
do,
Jeff?
Piece of,
you should, when they contact you and ask you questions, you should be like, I know you would like to pay me $100 for this Heathkit scope for your oscilloscope music. However, can I upsell you on a fan filter for a Tech? And then that's how you hook them. You hook them, and then you get another one in the community, and you're like, I'll meet you at the museum.
You buy a scope and you'll get fan filters for life.
For free. They just
fan filters
them in a box,
for life.
Use them as packing material.
Actually,
to be environmentally friendly, this packing material can be reused as a scope fan filter.
Your cathode ray tube has been carefully hand packed with fan filters to ensure a safe delivery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm aware that I have a problem. I'm aware that this has gone way too far. And that's so my great. New Year's resolution, and I'm not exaggerating or making this up, my New Year's resolution is to downsize my test equipment because I've got a lot of gear here that needs to go to another home, just because I've got, you know, duplicates of things, and I've got things that I bought for a project 10 years ago that I don't need anymore. And so, mark my words, this year I will be downsizing the test equipment pool.
Yeah.
Because I'd really like to have less of it here.
I'm just imagining Jeff as Bilbo Baggins being like, why? Why should they have it? Mine, my precious.
My precious. Wait, that's not Bilbo. That's Gollum, isn't it?
It's Bilbo at one point, though. It's the,
oh, because he gets like possessed by the ring.
Exactly,
ring.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's good to end on a Lord of the Rings reference. So I think you are also, you are needed at a local meetup, sir. So you should probably get skedaddling now that it's...
Yeah, hardware happy hour. As an aside, Tolkien's birthday was yesterday, by the way.
How do you possibly know that?
I know that because it came up in something I was listening to today. I can't remember. And Tolkien, I think, is said to be like the most influential fiction writer of like all time, because so many people have read those books or have been touched by those books in some way. But yeah, he was born on January 3rd, 1892. I had to look that
up. That's crazy. Do you know how many Zeppelin songs are about Lord of the Rings? That's what trips me out. Just like the coolest dudes, some of the coolest dudes to ever hit rock and roll. And they're just like reading Lord of the Rings.
They're nerds.
We should write songs about this. Like, they were just like so cool. And they wrote the nerdiest friggin' songs. Yeah. Misty
cool
Mountain Hop.
Cool.
You know, like... Just like there's so many Tolkien references in their songs, like not even that, like they're about, listen to a bunch of Zeppelin.
I'm not knowledgeable of the Zeppelin catalog, but I have an Apple Music subscription, so I'll have to add. What's your favorite Zeppelin album? Are you like a huge fan or?
Not a huge fan. My roommate used to be, and actually my roommate and former guest of the Amp Hour, Steve Cruiser. Probably, I never met anyone who listened to more Zeppelin than him, and I'm sure he still does. I don't think he listens to the show anymore, but yeah, so many songs.
Oh, it looks like Led Zeppelin 4 for the 1971 album won a poll by the Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
Followed by Physical Graffiti, 1975. Yeah. Well, anyway, I will add a bunch of these albums to my Apple Music so I can listen to them.
And there's a Rolling Stones piece that I just Googled, but just about Lord of the Rings, and it's crazy.
Misty Mountain Hop is on that 1971 album, so maybe I'll start there. That and that won the the Reader's Choice.
Ramble On is probably the big one of the biggest ones too. So like Ramble On is awesome. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, as you pointed out, Hardware Happy Hour starts in 23 minutes.
Send my best to all the Seattleites who are braving. What did you call it? You called it the
the Big Dark.
The Big Dark. Yes, the Big
Dark. For us, it's just life. It's like every. It's like a Thursday.
It is.
In Seattle.
Yeah,
it's just the way it is. But yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being back, Jeff. Happy Kaisermas, and we'll see you. We'll see you next year, probably in December next year. I think we'll shoot for this year. Sorry, this year we'll try and do it.
That'll be a double appearance year.
A double Kaisermas year. Yeah, that's right. 2024 year.
I can feel a disturbance in the force.
That's a different nerd franchise.
Actually, that'll be two Kaisermases in 1 year, which that's like one of those like off by one.
This
errors.
Is the 12th day of Kaisermas. Yeah. And then also, it also is maybe this is a leap year as well. So like, it's a leap
I think
Kaisermas
it is.
Year.
I think it is a leap year. Yeah. So it's thus as it has been foretold, there will be two Kaisermases in the year of 2024. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right, Jeff.
Yeah.
We'll see you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.